Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
That exposed water is basically acting as a heating pad, putting out that heat into the polar atmosphere.
Alaska's northernmost community is seeing a bizarrely warm winter. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 6th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Congress extends a program helping survivors of domestic violence.
So often there aren't resources for people who are on the receiving end of partner-related violence or intimidation.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What if accessing your personal and family immunization records was as easy as checking your phone? The Docket app is a secure option that allows Alaskans to quickly access their immunization records. Need immunization records for school or travel? Docket makes it simple and is available for download from the App Store or Google Play Store. Learn more at vaccinationrecords.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Temperatures in Utqiagvik broke 40 degrees on Monday, the highest ever recorded for the North Slope community in December. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports the unusual warm spell is at least in part due to climate change-driven loss of sea ice.
This time of year, Billy Adams would expect to see sea ice lining Utqiagvik's Chukchi Sea shoreline. But right now, it's all open water.
It was raining before Thanksgiving. Then it rained again, and it's December.
Adams lives in Utqiagvik and is an observer for the Alaska Arctic Observatory and Knowledge Hub, a coalition of northern communities that shares data about sea ice, wildlife, and coastal waters. Adams says this year there's no ice along the shore, and there's been a lot of snow and even rain in town.
You know, in the past years, it seems like it lasts only for a week. Then it was back to cold, but the last few months has been very unusually warm.
Temperatures in Utqiagvik broke 40 degrees on Monday, the highest ever recorded for the North Slope community in December. The unusual warm spell was driven in part by climate change, says climatologist Rick Toman with the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy.
The open water at this point, the first week in December in the Chukchi Sea, that is a very clear climate change signal there.
Toman says the latest jump in temperatures stems from a combination of warm air and rain moving north from the Bering Sea, plus the lack of Arctic sea ice.
That exposed water is basically acting as a heating pad, putting out that heat into the polar atmosphere.
Toman says the North Slope has seen progressively warmer winters in recent years, in part due to rapidly disappearing sea ice. High temperatures ranged in the upper 30s and low 40s across the North Slope Monday. Adams from Utqiagvik says he's concerned about what the spike could mean for caribou, an important subsistence animal. Warm weather tends to bring lots of snow, which he says makes it difficult for caribou to find food in the tundra.
We have to keep an eye out in the next few weeks, the next few months. And, you know, we hope to see that animals are still around.
A NOAA weather forecast shows temperatures in Utqiagvik are expected to drop into the teens and single digits by the end of the week. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
A dispute among Alaska Native corporations about carbon credit revenue is now in court. Three Native corporations are suing three others who've made at least $100 million and likely more selling carbon credits, saying they want their share under a four-decades-old revenue-sharing agreement. The corporations selling carbon credits say that revenue is different and not subject to the agreement. That's all according to reporting by Nat Herz, who writes at northernjournal.substack.com. Herz says the dispute goes back to the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and a 1982 legal settlement. Those say corporations that develop valuable natural resources on their land have to share the revenue with other corporations whose land under ANCSA didn't have such valuable natural resources. As Herz puts it, the lawsuit over carbon credits marks another era of disputes between the corporations.
When the law was approved and signed into law, I think everyone just kind of considered that this was going to be, you know, timber, metals, oil. But as it turned out, A, there were initially a huge amount of disputes about, like, how do you calculate these revenues? Can you deduct costs? What kind of costs can you deduct? Basically, for 10 years after the passage of this 1971 law, there was just unending lawsuits and litigation between the native corporations. In 1982, they signed a 120-page agreement that basically laid out in much more detail how the revenue sharing would apply. And that agreement really put a stop to all of the lawsuits for about 40 years when some of these native corporations started getting into this business of what's called carbon credits.
Yeah. So how do carbon credits factor in here? And if you could just give us a brief recap of what carbon credits even are.
Yeah. So carbon credits are a market, essentially, that was developed in this case as part of a system that was adopted in California to tax carbon emissions. And so companies and entities could set aside timberlands and promise not to cut them down for 100 years, and then they would be issued credits that could be traded to polluters as part of these carbon markets. There were three of the big regional Alaska Native corporations that got into these markets: Sea Alaska, which is based in Juneau, Chugach, which is kind of along Prince William Sound in the Kenai Peninsula, and Otna, which is more in the interior along the Copper River Valley. Also, some of the smaller village corporations got into this business. And while we don't know the exact amount of money and revenue that was at stake, Sea Alaska officials have said that they were paid more than $100 million for their carbon credits. And we know that, you know, there are two or three other corporations that did deals in the same kind of realm and likely of the same size. So pretty significant amount of money at stake. And what those native corporations decided was that, look, we are not cutting down our trees or selling our trees. So these are not revenues that are coming from disposing of our natural resources. And these are not revenues that we have to share 70% of with the other regional corporations.
Wait, let me guess what those other regional corporations say about it. They think they should have to share it.
Yeah, good guess. So this is where this kind of legal battle starts. So 2018, the native corporations initially began what is called an arbitration process. So this is sort of like a private, confidential court system that private entities can agree to as a way of keeping things out of the court system. And there's a private arbitration panel of attorneys that basically acts as a court, and there's a legal case made by both sides. So in 2018, all of the large regional native corporations that are not Sea Alaska, Chugach, and Otna, the companies that had done these deals, all of them made a demand for arbitration and said, look, we think these revenues should qualify. Over the ensuing 3 years, delayed because of COVID, they went through, you know, oral arguments and briefing of the legal questions. And over the summer, the arbitration panel came back with a unanimous decision and said, we agree with Sea Alaska, Otna, and Chugach. We don't think under this 1982 settlement agreement and under previous court precedent that these revenues should have to be shared. And the essential legal conclusion was that this is because Sea Alaska, Otna, and Chugach were not actually selling or disposing of any interest in the actual timber resources on their land. They were agreeing to a payment in exchange for them not cutting the trees down.
And I guess that gets us to this point where we're now talking about this as a lawsuit, right?
Yeah. So the arbitration dispute, I had been doing some reporting about Sea Alaska over the past year and had heard about the arbitration dispute, but because the arbitration is conducted in private, there were no public documents that would speak to the nature of dispute, what was at stake. And then finally, in October, there is an actual lawsuit filed as an appeal of the arbitration decision. And that's where all this stuff has to finally be laid out. publicly in documents that a reporter can go look at and pull from the courthouse and use to inform an audience.
That was reporter Nat Herz. If you want to be a member of his informed audience, check out northernjournal.substack.com. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Kenai man makes the top 20 in a national mullet contest.
In high school, I couldn't earn the mullet because I cared too much about what people thought. But I don't care what anyone thinks now, so.
That mullet is ahead and on ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Do you need health insurance? United Way Healthcare Navigators are here to help you understand your new Affordable Care Act coverage options and opportunity for savings. You can call 211 or text GETCOVEREDAK to 898-211 to connect to a healthcare navigator. Enrollment is open now through January 15th. Call 211 today. This message sponsored by United Way of Anchorage.
Ballots from six rural Alaska villages were not fully counted in Alaska's November elections. A Division of Elections official said the U.S. Postal Service failed to deliver them to the state election headquarters before the election was certified on November 30th. The Alaska Beacon reports that as a result, more than 250 voters in St. George, Leavelock, Ambler, Kiana, Kobuk, and Norvik had their ballots only partially counted. A spokesperson for the Postal Service said, quote, "We regret the issues caused by this incident and are reviewing the process with the Alaska Division of Elections to avoid any recurrence in future elections." Though the failed delivery did not change any election results, it adds to a record of rural voting problems this year. After the August special election for U.S. House, seven villages' ballots failed to reach elections officials in time to be counted. Also in August, two polling places failed to open as planned. In November, two other rural polling places opened late on Election Day. In addition, a disproportionately large number of ballots from rural Alaska were rejected in the June by-mail special primary to fill the U.S. House seat left vacant by the death of Congressman Don Young. Last year, the administration of Governor Mike Dunleavy proposed a bill that would allow the Division of Elections to mandate by-mail voting in small communities where hiring poll workers is difficult. That bill did not pass the legislature. Meanwhile, recounts in two Anchorage area legislative races are scheduled to take place this week. A state elections official says a recount is planned for tomorrow in the Senate District E race and for Thursday in the House District 15 race. The recounts will take place in Juneau. The recount in the Senate race was requested by Democrat Rosalind Casey, who was the first of the three candidates in that ranked vote contest to be eliminated. The race was won by Republican Kathy Geisel, a former Senate president. Incumbent Republican Representative Roger Holland also competed. Democrat Denny Wells requested a recount in the Anchorage House race. He finished seven votes behind Republican Representative Tom McKay after the final ranked vote tabulations. Wintry weather has maxed out emergency cold weather shelter capacity in Anchorage. On Monday, Mayor Dave Bronson proposed raising bed capacity at the city's largest shelter, the municipally owned Sullivan Arena, from 200 to 360. The Anchorage Assembly may consider the measure at its meeting tonight. City officials say the Sullivan shelter has been at capacity since late November, and on the coldest days, more than 100 people have waited in a warming space in the arena for a bed. Rob C. manages shelters for the municipality and says people do stay in the warming area overnight, though it's not supposed to be for sleeping and there aren't any cots.
Technically, they aren't supposed to. It's not supposed to be a sleeping quarters, like by code. But, you know, I mean, whether that's enforced all the time, that's another story.
The Muni has contracts for emergency cold weather shelters at multiple facilities around the city. With the exception of one being transitioned back to a hotel, they are also full. The Sullivan has the highest capacity and lowest barriers for entry. The Anchorage Assembly set the current bed capacity at 200, and that's half the pandemic levels. Members said they prefer having multiple smaller shelters to mass shelters and thought it would be easier to manage. Felix Rivera chairs the Assembly's Housing and Homelessness Committee He called the mayor's proposal to raise the Sullivan Arena's bed capacity an 11th-hour surprise. He has several questions and concerns for the administration.
The last thing that I want us to do as a policy of this city is to continue to burden one neighborhood with so much of our population experiencing homelessness and so much of the issues that surround that.
The mayor's proposal, if approved by the assembly, would increase capacity at the Sullivan through the end of March. Meanwhile, nonprofits the Muni is working with are wrapping up the purchase of two more hotels to convert to housing, and they're eyeing a third. In other parts of the state, though, shelter options are much more limited. Today on Talk of Alaska, officials with support organizations for people experiencing homelessness around Alaska discussed the challenges in funding emergency shelters. In Bethel, there's only one low-barrier emergency shelter for folks to go when the weather turns cold, and that's the Bethel Winter House. Eileen Arnold, executive director of the Tundra Women's Coalition, is a member of the finance committee for the Winter House. She said that the shelter is looking at a budget shortfall this year in part because funding for homelessness around the state focuses so much on long-term solutions.
In the meantime, we need to fund our safety net. And there hasn't been an increase, I believe, in that safety net for homelessness in the state of Alaska for quite some time. And I think that there needs to be, because even once permanent supportive housing is built, people are still going to need to access the Bethel Winter House.
Arnold says a 24-unit supportive housing project for Bethel Winter House is expected to be complete in 2024, and with it, they'll have access to more funding intended for long-term housing solutions. Congress has removed the sunset provision that could have brought an end to a federal program that arranges pro bono legal assistance to people seeking legal protection from domestic violence threats. KYUK's Francisco Martinez-Cuello has more from Bethel.
Thursday, December 1st, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the POWER Act, which assures the continuation of programs offering free legal aid to domestic violence victims. Representative Mary Peltola's bill of the same title was the companion to this Senate bill in the House. The bill has now gained final passage in Congress.
Some people call it domestic violence. But I think that we really should call it intimate partner-related violence, because sometimes it's somebody you're dating.
Peltola says that victims are too often unable to escape the perpetrators of their trauma, to devastating effect.
So often there aren't resources for people who are on the receiving end of partner-related violence or intimidation, and they don't have the legal resources to help them navigate ways to keep that person away, their perpetrator away from them.
This legislation removes the sunset provision from earlier legislation. The 2018 Pro Bono Work to Empower and Represent Act, sponsored by Senators Dan Sullivan and Jean Shaheen, authorizing a pilot project calling for each district court to hold at least one event annually in concert with domestic violence service providers to promote pro bono legal services for partner-related violence and intimidation cases. Additionally, to address the appalling victimization rates among Alaska Natives and American Indians in particular, the bill pushes partnerships between district courts, tribes, and tribal organizations.
Certainly, this is really, really prevalent among Alaska Natives. Partner-related violence. So the other really great thing about this is that the bill also encourages and mandates partnerships between district courts and tribes and tribal organizations. So I think this is a really important step in the right direction.
Since its enactment, the POWER Act has brought together service organizations and lawyers with the goal of combating high rates of violence and intimidation endemic across the United States. Representative Mary Peltola wants to help more people find these resources and communicate with young people about healthy relationships and how to safely get out of unhealthy relationships. In Bethel, I'm Francisco Martinez-Cuello.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks, featuring hot breakfast, Wi-Fi, and a fitness center. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
Alaska's longest and most popular hunting season ended early this year. The Delta Junction bison hunt usually extends from October to March, but the state limited this year's season to just 2 weeks, and only 50 animals were taken because last winter's heavy snow and ice buildup wiped out nearly a third of the Delta bison herd. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The Delta bison hunt is by far the most popular for any game species in the state. Hunters submitted more than 44,000 applications last year in hopes of drawing a permit to harvest one of the 120 animals the state had planned to make available this year.
That's definitely the highest number ever.
Alaska Department of Fish and Game Delta Area Wildlife Biologist Bob Schmidt says state managers had to rethink their plan for this year's hunt after finding out about 180 bison, or nearly a third of the 600 animal herd, died of starvation last winter. Schmidt says they weren't able to eat because storms dumped snow and ice that covered the grass and sedges that bison feed on.
Last winter was a winter like we've never seen, and it was really the rainstorm right after Christmas that was really hard on wildlife across much of interior Alaska, and particularly bison.
Schmidt says the magnitude of the die-off became evident last spring.
They looked really bad well into the summer. They, you know, even the survivors were really skinny and in poor shape.
So game managers reduced the number of bison that could be harvested this year from 120 to 50, and they cut the length of the hunt from 6 months to 2 weeks. But Schmidt says the hunters reached that quota in half that time during the abbreviated hunt held last month.
Normally they'd be hunting all the way till March, but this time it was, you know, get up here, wham, bam, get it done, you know, no messing around kind of a deal.
Schmidt says he sees signs that the Delta herd is rebounding, and if so, Fish and Game likely will extend the season in the next year or two and increase the harvest quota. He says the objective is to maintain a sustainable herd of about 360 bison, not too large, so as to limit the damage they cause by trampling on area farmers' fields and raiding their stores of hay and feed.
So we probably don't want to let it get all the way back to 600. You know, there's some agreements we've got in place with the ag community to try to stay, you know, closer to that 360.
The Delta bison hunt attracts more applications every year than any other game in Alaska. It's an iconic species that's prized by hunters, not the least because it provides hundreds of pounds of meat per animal. And the six-month-long season gives hunters time to regroup and return to the area as often as needed in that time frame to find the ideal specimen.
This bison hunt, it's pretty much a once-in-a-lifetime hunt.
Schmidt says he feels bad for hunters who drew permits and weren't able to get in on this year's hunt. He suggests they consider appealing to the State Board of Game before the April deadline for another opportunity to reapply for permits for the 2024 hunt and ask the board to waive the required waiting period. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
It takes confidence to rock a bold hairstyle. One man on the Kenai Peninsula credits his nationally ranked mullet to learning to care less and embrace the flow. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
Depending on who you ask, mullets are making a big comeback. The business in the front, party in the back hairstyle, famously worn by hockey players and rock stars in the 1980s and 90s, has made its way back into the canon in the 2020s. That trendiness doesn't really matter to 31-year-old Joe Malatesta of Kenai. He's been growing out his own curly mullet for 4 years, just for kicks. And he says when he sees another person rocking one, it signals to him that they also don't take themselves too seriously.
Like, they don't care what people think. They're just here to have a good time. In high school, I couldn't earn the mullet because I cared too much about what people thought. But I don't care what anyone thinks now, so.
Malatesta may not care what anyone thinks about his hair, but his mullet did get approval from the online masses when he ranked in the top 25 of the 2022 USA Mullet Championship. The competition is just 2 years old, tracking with the resurgence of mullets in popular culture. In it, mullet wearers go head-to-head through several rounds, culminating in a public vote and crowning of the top three finalists. Malatesta heard about the national competition from friends this fall and sent in some headshots. When it came to the voting, he relied on his fraternity brothers and locals to spread the word online and raked in just over 500 votes overall, placing him in 19th out of almost 500 entries. The first place winner from New York State got 3,700 votes. But Malatesta hasn't always had the carefree attitude to rock the hair. Growing up in Soldotna, it was more of an idea.
It was one of those things that, like, growing up, like, I kind of grew up in, like, that shag, you know, era. Everyone was rocking shags. I hated it. I hated my hair and my face. It was one of those things that I was like, man, I feel like a mullet would be awesome because I could rock long hair, which I wanted, without the hair in my face.
But mullets weren't really in yet, and he said he cared too much about what people thought at the time. Then in 2018, he was going through some personal battles and needed a pick-me-up.
And I thought it'd be hilarious to start growing a mullet. So one day, I just walked into my boss's office and was like, hey, I'm going to grow a mullet. You cool with that? And she kind of laughed at me and was like, I don't care. I was like, I'm serious. Like, I'm going to grow a mullet. And she's like, yeah, go ahead.
Malatesta works with the Alaska Department of Family and Community Services. He's also getting his master's in social work. And today, his hair is a good talking point for clients and for strangers. He said people approach him in the street and ask to take pictures.
I've been shocked to see how many people, like, will comment about the mullet just in random passing. Mm-hmm. So, and then in work, it is a solid place to start talking. So obviously what I do isn't something that people enjoy if I'm around. So it's fun. I think they, mm-hmm. you know, I've talked to clients about that too, and puts him a little more at ease, a little more comfortable.
Today, his mullet is just a part of him. He changes with the seasons. He shears the sides shorter in the summer and grows them out a bit longer in the winter. Both of his sons, ages 3 and 4, also have mullets. And he says he's surprised how long he's kept it up.
But yeah, no, I really enjoy having my long hair. So I don't know. I'm going to rock it till I can.
Mullets are also a helpful social signifier. Malatesta says he knows others who are rocking the mullet have good vibes, too.
Because, yeah, I mean, my general assumption with people who are rocking a mullet is, A, they don't care about much, and they're just around to have a good time. So, like, however that good time means. Like I said, I'm not a drinker, so that party life isn't really my style. But that doesn't mean I can't have a good time, so.
You can see pictures of Malatesta and the other 2022 finalists at mulletchamp.com. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Kavitha George and Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Francisco Martinez Cuello in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, and Sabine Pooks with that amazing mullet story out of Kenai. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Madeline Rose produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank, Alaska, celebrating 100 years of helping Alaskans shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.